Neu in der Deutschlandcard-App. Sammle Punkte mit deinen Kassenbons von DM, Rossmann und vielen weiteren Supermärkten und Drogerien. Einfach Kassenbons scannen, punkten und sparen. Jetzt gratis mit der Deutschlandcard-App.
On today's episode of Lucas Inside Track, I'm joined by Mimi Nicklin. Mimi is the world's foremost expert when it comes to empathy. She's trained over 20,000 people around the world to become better at delivering empathy in the workplace and also beyond. She's also a best-selling author twice. On the show today, I'm going to talk to her about how empathy can make the world a better place and how actually it helps drive business growth. So join me in the episode. It's going to be a cracker. Mimi Nicklin in the house. How are you doing, Mimi?
Good morning. Oh, I'm so happy to be here. I'm not sure I'm an expert, by the way.
What would you call yourself?
I don't know. Well,
way to kill the viewers.
I'm sorry, viewers. But it feels like such a big word,
it is,
right?
It is.
Like
I'm putting pressure on you.
Expert. I'm like, my gosh, am I an expert? Maybe I am, but you know, thanks for saying it.
Yeah, look, you've written books, you've trained people, you're an expert. Okay. You're an expert.
I'll accept it.
By the way, it's amazing that we're also in sync color-wise.
I know. It's a sign. I believe in that, you know.
Do you?
Universal signs. Clearly, it's meant to be a really good conversation.
100%.
There we go.
There's a part of me that, you know, because I've done a bit of my research on you, and it says empathy is all about listening.
This is true.
So I'm really rethinking everything about today's episode recording.
Pressure?
I have to listen super intently and showcase how empathetically wonderful I am.
Listen, I think you've got it. I think you've got it grasped. Mainly because of the industries you came from. You've been listening as a job, basically forever.
Yeah.
So
listening to clients, listening to people whine and whine and all that kind of stuff.
The industry.
Yeah, that doesn't change, by the way. People are still in the industry keep telling me the same thing. So.
There you go. It's never going to change, right? It never will.
But you were also in the same industry. You also came from an ad background.
I did. And I was one of those really rare people, Luca, that always wanted to do it.
Yeah.
So I think most people in the advertising media world fell into it. You know, when you ask people in advertising or media, what did you do? Like a million different degrees will come up.
Yeah.
But for me, my dad was an ad man. Did you ever watch Mad Men on Netflix?
Yeah, of course. Okay. Don, what a legend.
My dad was literally like those men. That was his life. When advertising was really cool.
Yeah.
And like glamorous.
In the 60s, 70s.
Yes, in London, you know, they had these long lunches and it was, you know, shoots for like $2 million. So I always just wanted to be like him. So from 12 years old,
very nice.
I wanted to be in advertising. Yeah. So it was my life. Really.
And you've worked in Dubai, but our paths never cross, even though we sort of belong to the same group, same company group. It's crazy.
Really. It is amazing. Yeah. But here we are. It brought us back in the end.
There you go, man. Empathy, the world.
Empathy, just exactly.
The world listened and the world brought
there
you here.
There it is.
Look at that.
There it is.
Now talk to me about your mug. There's a rather large letter on it. Tell those who can't see what's happening.
There is. There is a rather large. In fact, there's a small one and a big one. Like it's double-sided.
Oh, yeah. Look at that.
So shall I tell you the truth?
Yes.
When you asked me to bring my favorite mug, I ignored you. Sorry.
A lot of people do.
No.
Of my wife, by the
way. Don't say that. Because my absolute favorite mug is from India, and it's actually quite unlike me, but it's very intricate, and it's got an elephant and gold leaf on it. And I just thought, because I live in Malaysia, and I flew up here for your show, Luca.
Look at that.
I couldn't bear to put it in a suitcase because I thought, what if Emirates breaks my mug? So I brought my second favorite
Look
mug,
at that.
Right? So my second favorite mug has a massive and a small M on it for Mimi. And the reason I love it is because about 2 years ago, I met a young woman in Sri Lanka and she came to one of my workshops. And safe to say, she became very smitten with the work of empathy and what I was doing. She was very shy. And she asked me whether I would do a training course for her family business in Sri Lanka, which is a very traditional family business. And she had no idea how she was going to broach this with her father, but she wanted to. So it took us 2 years of sort of coaching and discussion and patience. And eventually, about 4 months ago, I did that workshop with her family. They were all there, mum, dad, brothers, everyone, true family business.
Very nice.
And we had this phenomenal workshop. And this mug was the gift she gave me. And so it's very sentimentally connected to me because it really represents patience maybe, but also just tenacity and lives becoming intertwined, right? Yeah. Because this young woman, I never knew. Now I know her so well. I know her mum and her dad and everybody else. So yeah, this is my second favorite mug.
Very nice.
And well, it is a representation of that relationship.
Well, we're honored to steal it and take it, put it back on the mantle.
Don't tell her, okay? She'll be devastated.
No, she can come as well anytime. But speaking of training, so you trained over 20,000 people around the world?
I know, it's bonkers. I sometimes don't believe that.
I love that word, bonkers.
Bonkers.
It's such an English word.
Oh, it's such a great word.
Explain bonkers to people in the Middle East. What does it mean?
Oh, yes. Bonkers means kind of crazy.
Yeah. Nuts.
Yeah, like nuts, like crazy, but with a kind of, it's quite a gentle word. Mm. You know,
it's not harsh.
It's not harsh. It's a fun word. And yeah, I even, you know, when I go to these events and they read my bio on stage, and they talk about all these big numbers, which of course I put in my bio. Like I wrote it.
You can't blame them, man.
No, like I wrote it. But I still listen to it and think, oh yeah, I did that. Mm. And it amazes me every time. So I think, yes, 20,000 is a big number, but apparently I have done it.
What kind of feedback do you get off of these 20,000 people? Or is it a case of you do the workshop, do the training, and then you never see them again? Or do you have similar stories to the lady who got you the mug?
I have so many. Shall I tell you another amazing one?
Tell me the one that came to your mind first.
So this one happened here, okay. And I do talk about it quite a lot. And I actually wrote about it in my new book because I don't think it will ever leave me, Luca. So I did a large conference last year in Dubai in June, and there was about 500 people in the audience from the Gulf. So it's unusually for Dubai. There were basically no expats in the room at all. This was a very Gulf
very event. Local.
So Emiratis, Bahrainis, Omanis, Saudis, Qataris, but it was very, very Gulf driven. So I did my speech. And at the end, this Emirati man came, you know, really beelined for me. I could see him coming. And he came to me and he said, you know, thank you for your session. I said, well, you know, you're welcome. And then he looked at me and he said, Mimi, I think I've made a huge mistake. And you can imagine, Luca, that was quite a big statement in the middle of a hall. And, you know, everyone in your audience probably knows a lot about the Middle East. But for anyone who doesn't, there's quite a big cultural gap between an Emirati man and a foreign female. Mm-hmm. So it was definitely the first time that something like that had happened. So I smiled and I said, okay, sir, you know, would you like to tell me about this? And he said, so yesterday my son came home from school and he had bad grades. And I shouted at him, and I think I really hurt him, Mimi. So with your permission, I'm going to leave this event, and I'm going to pick him up from school today, and I'm going to take him for dinner, and I'm going to ask him why. Because I realized, listening to you, that I never asked him at all. So he did that. And then I guess about 24 hours later, he sent me a WhatsApp.
You gave him his number.
Yeah, I gave him my number and he sent me a WhatsApp and he said, Mimi, I did that. And I asked my son what happened. Oh, it makes me a bit emotional. And I think you may have changed our family forever. Wow. So that type of feedback, Luca, that type of feedback really makes this work feel worthwhile, because fundamentally, I tend to teach leaders. But more and more on this journey, we're talking about life. Yeah. We're talking about family. We're talking about relationships. So for me, that type of feedback, well, I get up another day and do it again.
It just validates and re-energizes you, I'm guessing, to keep doing it. And look, it's very obvious how much you love what you do. I mean, your energy right now, from the minute you walked in that door, you're glowing, right? Because you found your natural wave, you're on the pathway that you should be doing. There might be a million other pathways for you, but this pathway is definitely suiting you. And it's so easy to see and to feel, by the way. So the feeling that you get from these types of people are amazing. Mm. The question then I have to you is your job fundamentally, yes, it's about, you know, balancing humanism and capitalism and getting workplaces to make more money through empathy.
Yeah.
But also your job is kind of to make the world a better place.
Yeah, I believe so now, but I didn't always believe that. I think I started this work about 5 years ago, and I felt at the time that really my swim lane, as it were, and for anyone whose mother tongue is not English, what that really means is my path that I felt validated or valid to teach on was the business world, right? So if you had asked me 5 years ago, are you trying to change the world? Are you trying to impact relationships or impact longevity of life, which now I do quite a lot around? I would have said, me? No way, right? I can just about handle, you know, handle the corporate world. But the more I did it, the more I realized, to your point, that yes, this is about changing the world. And the amazing thing is that everyone can do it.
Yeah.
Everyone can change the world. I mean, you're doing it. How do you feel?
Yeah.
You get to do this all the time.
It is. And it's a fantastic feeling. And honestly, for those who don't know, I don't just record one episode per day. Sometimes I do two or three episodes back to back. And by the end of it, I'm not tired. I'm super energized.
No, I know that feeling.
I absolutely love it. But to your point, you said your job was about corporate first and foremost.
Yes.
Did you feel that you weren't allowed to think beyond that because you were rooted in it? That was your background. You didn't have the credibility to start putting yourself on stage saying, hey, by the way, I'm here to change the world one person at a time through better listening,
yeah.
through non-judgment,
yeah.
from actually trying to understand what someone and how they're going through things. So you probably didn't feel you had the credibility because you come from the corporate background. But the more you've disassociated yourself from that background,
I think so.
You're sort of freeing yourself up more. I feel it as well, by the way. I'm like, when I first launched this, I'm like, what? I've got to keep it close to what I know.
Yep.
What do I know is marketing. What do I know? Hence insight.
Yes.
What do I know about the corporate world?
Yep.
But now the more I do it, the more I'm like, I'm allowing myself to dream beyond just the corporate life and to have people on the show who aren't my typical type of guest. You know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. And I think it's also being very open to, let's say, signs from those around you. And some people might say it's from God. Some people might say it's from the universe. Whatever you believe, you have to be open to those signs. So to your question, yes, I felt like this was the only area I could speak in. But slowly, slowly, I started to listen to what other people told me. And of course, it's always hard to listen to the people that are closest to you because you think they're being nice.
Yeah.
But people kept telling me, I think you can do more. But I didn't necessarily believe in myself then.
Yeah.
Today, I'm closer to that, Luca. Yeah. I'm closer to that because of these stories, and I could tell you many of the things that people say to me about how I make them feel. And then I think, okay, well, I'll carry on then.
It feels good though, doesn't it? I know it's weird in a way, but it's a bit selfish with the feeling that you get, because it's like a bit of a drug. You get this kind of addiction to making others feel better, and you can see it on their faces.
Yes.
And you feel so good about yourself, and maybe feel, oh, shouldn't I feel so good about this? I'm making money, I'm being successful, and I'm doing what I love. Have you ever felt guilty about that?
I've never felt guilty for helping other people, for sure.
But have you felt guilty about getting paid for doing something that you love?
No, but
good.
But
that's important because a lot of people do.
But I mean, I think probably for any mothers watching and perhaps some fathers too, where the guilt comes in is I sometimes feel guilty for loving so much of what I do when it takes me away from my child.
Yeah. You have a 7-year-old daughter,
right? I do. Well done. Yes, she's 7.
Okay. Yeah. How's she doing in school?
I don't know. I don't attend with her, but rumor has it she's doing okay.
Yeah. So when the dad spoke to you about his son's grades, was there anything thinking about how you speak to your own
daughter?
Yes.
Well, I mean, I'm a great believer that she can run her own life, really. So my belief in motherhood is very much that for me, I have to enable her to live without me. And that sounds very scary, but I always wanted to believe, and I was a single mom for a long time. I always wanted to believe that if I'm not around because I'm traveling or through sickness or through anything, that I would bring up a young girl, woman, that can do it all herself.
Yeah.
And she can, Luca. You know, we travel, we go to restaurants. You know, she really can. She
kids
can read
tough,
rooms.
Man. Kids are resilient.
Oh,
they're
my God,
tough,
and they're amazing.
Look, I was 6 when I went to boarding school. I was in full boarding school when I was 6 years old.
Can you remember
And everyone
that?
Always tells me that, oh God. At the time, it was normal because I didn't know anything else. So it was, but it makes you feel like you can achieve and do anything and you can get on with anybody. And you have that independence and that sort of strength of character to adapt.
Yeah.
And kids have that. They have that in buckets. But we as adults, we always try and protect and over, you know,
which is
right. But at the same time, you've got to let them fly as well.
Oh, they know so much that we don't because they see everything. You know, we live through a filter. We live through our own filter. You know, lots of my work is in helping people realize that you are only responding and listening to what you want to hear or what you think the person is going to ask.
Based on your own bias.
Based on your own bias, experience, judgment, opinion, all of these things, right? Which the media makes sound, these are very negative things, but Luca, they're not. You know, judgment, bias, they come with this real weight.
Heavy.
But they're not. We all have biases. You know, we go back to my daughter for a minute. If she doesn't want to eat breakfast in the morning, right before school, I'm like, okay, don't eat breakfast. For some mums, this is like, oh my gosh, you cannot possibly send this child into the world without food in the morning. That's their
that's
bias.
My mom.
That's my mom. That's your mum.
My mom
is probably
would just
mine.
Stuff me with food every time I'm there, yeah.
But that's a bias. There's nothing wrong with that. She biases that they should eat. I bias it doesn't matter. Yeah. I'm making it up. But you know what I mean?
I'm with you.
These heavy words, right? Yeah. I'm sure on your show, people feel nervous of them, right? Have you seen that?
Seen what? Felt nervous?
Of the word bias and judgment.
I feel like there's a lot of people don't always say what they want to say because they're worried about being judged.
So
they're in their shell and they are much more open to talk about things that are important off camera. They come on camera and they kind of stay at 35,000 feet.
Yeah, it's true.
That's what annoys me the most because the authenticity, the real stuff, what's in the gut, what's in the heart, that's the good stuff.
Yeah.
But they don't show that. Or if they do show it, they show the glossy kind of version of it. So I'm not just talking about people on my show. I'm talking about in general, people on camera. They're not always their true self. And working in this side of the business, you start to see that more and more.
Do you think that happens more in Dubai? Do you think there's more pressure to be somebody else here than other places?
God, who's hosting who today?
Sorry.
No, you've got, I mean,
but
look,
it's
look,
a good
it's
question,
a, it is a great
right?
question.
Because
look,
you
Dubai,
see so much of
I'll
that
tell you,
here.
Dubai, there isn't a faster city in the world.
No,
than
I
Dubai.
Agree.
I've been to New York. I've worked a little bit in New York. I've worked in London. I've worked a little bit around the region. There is nothing and nowhere like Dubai. Mm. It's so fast that literally time acts differently here to everywhere else. You look at your watch, it's like it's 11 o'clock in the morning. Like where's the time? And then it's 3 p.m. Then it's 6 p.m. Like what happened to the day? And people are so absorbed in delivering work because it is an expat city.
Mm.
It is a place where, you know, historically, if you didn't have a job, you couldn't work, you couldn't live here.
Mm.
So you lose your job, you're out of the country, historically speaking, right? Yeah. Things are obviously changing now. So it put a huge emphasis on the working side of things, right? So making money is everything. And Dubai is a catchment area for the Middle East. So if you're from Lebanon or from Egypt, for example, Syria, Iraq, places that don't have really strong home domestic economies, Dubai becomes an amazing opportunity for you to make money so you can help people back home. And a lot of people do that. So Dubai is very nuanced in the sense where, yes, you have the glitz, the glamour, Dubai bling style approach, but at the core of it, it's just people wanting to make money to help protect their families back home.
Mm.
That's really what that's what the human insight is. And people can be fake, but they can be fake anywhere. Dubai isn't specific just for that.
Mm.
But you have a higher penetration of millionaires and billionaires in Dubai than anywhere else. So there is that layer of richness that you have exposed to. But nice question. Right. Safe question, right? I'm going to ask you for your safe word. What is your safe word, Mimi?
Can I choose any word, like literally any word?
You can choose anything. Just don't make a pineapple for the
Why?
Love of... Yeah, I've had, I think 9 people have said pineapple on the show.
Pineapple?
Yeah, yeah.
We could make some judgment, but should we not?
PG. Let's keep it PG.
Shall we just move on? Okay, I'm going to say lily because we spoke about them earlier.
Very nice.
And it's my favorite flower.
Is it?
Yeah.
Isn't it symbolize death, lily?
Oh my gosh, I don't know, but I like them. Now I don't. You've ruined it
but
forever.
Isn't that what you give typically at funerals?
I think you do, but you also see them at weddings, so...
Okay.
They're like,
maybe
they're multifaceted. The lily is multifaceted. So don't ruin it for me.
All right. Lily is your safe word.
Lily's my safe word. Right.
Great. Amazing. So in a nutshell, right? What is empathy?
What is empathy? In a nutshell, empathy is perspective taking.
So the ability to listen, to understand without judgment, without bias.
And without agreement. So you don't have to agree like what someone is saying to be able to understand it.
How do you know if someone is very good or very empathetic versus not? How quickly can you judge?
I think people can feel it. Well, if the question is me personally, obviously I do this every day. So I have like a radar, like an empathy radar. But for most people, instinctively, they can feel it. Children, we spoke about it earlier, children know, but you will know. When people listen to you, I often ask people in my workshops, Luca, how do you feel when someone listens to you? And I go around the audience and I ask for words and they say respected, confident, liked, happy. Often they say happy, motivated, inspired, all of these words. There's no bad word, right? So then I say to them, well, I'm going to carry on and do this masterclass. But the reality is you all know.
Yeah.
And the reason I do that is to prove to you that you already knew this before I came into the room, right? So we know what it feels like to be listened to. And I often play a video of my daughter actually in my workshops because she does it so beautifully. And I ask her in this video, What how do you feel when someone doesn't listen to you? And she says, she's so cute. She says, when someone doesn't listen to you, you feel sad and you feel that they're not your friend, right? We know. If you don't listen to me, you're not interested in me. It's instinctive.
Mm. Yeah, kids have a great way of just basically simplifying everything.
Everything.
And honestly, that's empathy is simple.
It is simple. Well, it's simple, but not necessarily easy. And I say that because it takes a bit of time. You know, you can't empathize with someone when you're running for a train, right? It takes time. Empathy has two great enemies. One is high stress and the other is low time. And I would imagine if we asked your entire audience, put your hand up if you have high stress and low time, you know, most people would put their hand up. So it is easy, but it's not always something that we make time for.
And you believe we're in a bit of an empathy deficit right now.
It's not just that I believe it. We are in an empathy deficit. So we have lost 48% of it over 30 years. And you only need to turn on the news. Probably let's not do that, right? It's too heavy. But if you turn on the news and look at what's going on around the world, we are living in an empathy deficit. We, quite frankly, don't have enough understanding of the people that we share our world with.
So some of the symptoms of that, or things that the sort of outputs are depression, loneliness, suicide.
Yes.
Isn't that crazy? Just from something as simple as not listening well or not understanding can lead to such long-term mental and potential fatal issues.
Mm, complete social collapse, actually. So
give me some numbers.
I have so many.
Give me those numbers.
But I mean, as we're a pro-social species, right? We are born to be connected. It's pro-evolutionary, Luca. We have to be connected. It's one of the reasons the pandemic was so hard on people. So yes, we have 400 million people with depression. This one's really sad. 335 million people don't have a single friend.
Wow.
Yeah.
How would they know that? How do you get that data? Is that from Gallup?
From Gallup. Nearly everything I use often is from Gallup or Mercer. But yeah, so it's a very lonely world. Statistically, about 52% of us, so half the planet, are lonely.
These are above 18-year-olds, right? 335 million are above 18.
I actually don't know. The honest truth is whether that data includes below 18 or above, but it's a huge percentage of our world. And the important thing to understand about loneliness is it's not about being alone. You can be lonely, but not alone. Like you were talking about Dubai just now, it's very rare to be alone in Dubai. We're constantly surrounded by people in this city that never sleeps. Yeah. But you can still be deeply lonely without being physically alone.
Because you don't have that connected.
Because, connection and belonging. You know, people that have belonging statistically live 8 years longer. Those that don't have it, statistically, it's as dangerous to their health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So it's bad for us, right? However you look at it, it's bad performance, it's bad for health, it's bad for society, it's terrible for our children.
From a business perspective, you mentioned performance. What does that look like now? If you don't have empathy in the workplace, what is the productivity loss, if you like, of disengaged employees?
Do you want to know a big number?
I know the number, but I want you to know.
You knew it already. So it's 8.8.
Just teeing it up.
You've got it on a piece of paper over there. It's $8.8 trillion annually, right? Which is
$8.8 trillion of lost revenue income from poor productivity owing to lack of empathy.
Exactly, which is equal to nearly 9% of global GDP, right? So if you want to know, can better human connection, empathy, improve our world and build our economy? The answer is yes, right? So these are huge numbers. But on a smaller level, we know, you know, here in MENA, in fact, if we speak for an hour, Luca, today, in the 1 hour that we speak, MENA will have lost $50.1 million.
Wow.
In an hour. So the numbers are huge. And companies that do have it have 23% higher profit.
But why? Okay, this is amazing. But why aren't companies taking this more seriously?
Well, I think it's changing, which is phenomenal. You know, I often think about when I started this, which was here, right? So my story very much, not that you asked, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
My story. I'm empathetic.
There you go. Listen, Luca. But my story started here in Dubai. And I remember at that time, it was about 2018, and I would broadcast every day to like this big black hole of social media thinking, is anybody listening? And probably they weren't.
Yeah.
But I carried on anyway.
We've all been there.
I carried on anyway, right? Today, I think they are, but that's good. You know, that's a different story. So really 5 years ago, really nobody was interested, I think. You know, it just wasn't a thing. I remember when I discovered this work, I couldn't believe that nobody was talking about it.
Yeah.
But today that is changing. You know, today I get opportunities to meet people like you. It just proves the fact, like you said earlier, we could have met a million different ways in the city. We never did. Yeah. But the conversation around empathy brought us together through mutual connections, right? So it's changing. I think most people don't know what it is. That's the problem.
Yeah. I've got an elephant in the room here.
Have you?
Yeah, I have.
Amazing.
And
go on then.
It allows me to ask questions that are quite straight up.
What does the elephant want to know?
So my worry is things like empathy are a buzz. They're a trend. Mm. They come in the door. They're great for a couple of years. They go out the door.
Mm.
Is that a danger? Do you worry that people, companies, governments are not even considering this long term?
I don't worry in my work, right? I think it will become a buzzword and I think it will trend and I think it's just beginning. So somebody the other day, Luca, this shows how old I am, but somebody said to me on LinkedIn, you are the OG of empathy. And I like messaged my younger sister and I was like, what does OG mean, right? So for me and my work, I don't think this will ever stop growing. There will always be more people, more organizations that know they need to reconnect their workforces because there are just too many issues with engagement, with attrition, with motivation, with health and well-being.
Yeah.
It will probably trend like, you know, psychological safety and purpose and intentional living and gratitude and all those other words that come in and go out. But the fundamental need for empathy is human. It's built into your prefrontal cortex.
Mm-hmm. We all
this
have
is
it.
Not a fad. This is built into your brain, right? You were born with this ability. You have to be able to connect with other people in order to survive. So we're talking about the survival of the human race. It can't trend. It has to maintain.
Well, we hope it doesn't.
Well, we hope it doesn't because then we're in trouble.
Yeah, we're in big trouble. There's a lot of books talking about radical candor in the workplace. Yes. How do you feel about that? Someone being very direct and blunt and putting their own opinion out there to someone so they know exactly where they stand.
Look, I think it probably works for different people. For me, I find it quite hard. You know, I always find working in America, for example, culturally very difficult. And that's probably because I've spent 20 years in Asia, Middle East, where we build relationships and connections and we're interested in each other and we have conversation before we put the deal on the table. And then when I go to the States and they're like, hi, Mimi, nice to meet you. So this is what we're talking about. Can I have that? You know, I'm like, hang on, right? Like, how are you?
Yeah.
Right? You know, can we have a moment of connection first? So I find radical candor very hard because I think many people don't deliver it very well. Mm. But people should be able
skill.
To share.
That's a skill, by the way. Delivering feedback in itself is a massive skill. But have you noticed how nuanced skill set feedbacks are across the world? So how we give feedback in the Middle East versus in the UK versus in Asia, right?
Yes.
In Japan,
yes,
right?
Absolutely.
Versus the US. It's so nuanced. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, even how you use your eyes, what different body language means, showing your hands. You know, all kinds of different things. I watched a show recently that was about body language and they were talking about in America how different hand movements impact the nation, right?
Yeah.
In terms of, I guess, neuro processing. But yeah, when you look at that from just not a non-purely American lens,
yes,
it's so different all around the world. Some of those things you could do in the East and it's not going to get you very
far. Have you noticed also with the Brits, they're very good at skirting around the issue. When something is bad, like someone's done a really bad presentation, like, yeah, I thought, you know, this was really good, but maybe you can think about potentially adding, maybe just adding 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
Whereas the Americans would be like, cha, they'll go straight in. The Japanese would tell you it's all amazing.
Yeah.
But they don't think that at all. So again, there is a cultural lens that you have to also apply when it comes to giving feedback. But also, is that the case also for listening? Do you have to adapt your listening style?
You do.
And your questioning based on the country you're in?
The core of listening is human, right? So that's going to be very similar all over the world. But how you deliver it, So for example, eye contact you mentioned there, Luca, is very different. In Northern Asia, so in Japan and Northern Asia, the way you use your eye contact is going to be very different from in some of the Western markets. And fundamentally, it comes to the difference between high context versus low context cultures.
Yeah.
So, you know, I work a lot in, for example, in Africa and parts of Asia where we have very collectivist societies and very traditional structures in many ways. So in those countries and probably parts of the Gulf as well, although I haven't personally experienced it here, you might have somebody in the workforce who's your boss, who out of work, you are the chief's daughter, right? So in the organization, they are your senior report, but in life, you are more senior than them, right? Yeah. So those high context cultures, they're a bit of a...
That's family. That's family reporting as well. When you add a family...
It's complex,
when you add
right?
a family dimension to the workplace.
It is complicated.
I want the audience watching and listening to understand the types of questions and how to best listen, right?
Right, yes, we
so
can do that.
So any little small cheeky tips and tricks that you can give through the approach. So let's put me, I'm going, I don't know, give me a scenario. You're pretty better than this.
Let me give you a scenario. Okay. So why don't we make that scenario? Why don't we pretend that you have a team member? They're of equal level. They're in your team. They're not your boss.
Okay.
That never listens.
Okay.
In your team. And you are asking me, Mimi, how do I approach that? How do I overcome that? How do I get them to listen to me better?
Yeah. Okay.
Does that work?
Yeah, it works.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome.
Mimi, I'm really upset. I'm honestly, I've had enough. It's ridiculous. This person just is a literal massive obstacle to getting stuff done. Mm. Right? We're not working together. They never take my ideas on board. They don't even listen to what I'm ever trying to say. And they keep interrupting me as well. So and they are desperate to impress the boss more than that, they're not allowing me the space to operate because I think they're a bit worried. I think they're feeling that competition. Mm. So what do I do? How do I manage that?
Luca, have you ever mentioned this to him before? I'm assuming it's a man.
Yeah.
Is it a man?
We'll call it a man.
We'll call it a man.
Bob.
Right. Bob.
Great.
Best mates. Have you ever mentioned this to Bob? Do you think he... Let me reframe that, Luca. Is he aware, do you think, of this?
I don't think he is aware of it.
Mm.
If he was aware of it, I don't know if it would change things as well.
Look, the reason I ask that is because more often than not, people aren't aware, and that's sometimes badly intentioned and sometimes not. Have you ever tried asking him for your opportunity to speak when you're in those meetings?
Do I ask him for...
Have you ever said to him, for example, hey, Bob, could you give me a moment to actually share my opinion here?
No, I haven't said it like that. I've just tried to interrupt him. Okay.
So one of the things I often find, Luca, with people that find it very hard to listen, and Bob sounds like he might be one of these people, is that, and you said earlier that there may be, he's trying to impress, right? So he may have some self-confidence issues. You have no idea why he's on speed drive the whole time, right? But he will have his reasons because everybody does.
Yeah.
Often people aren't aware that they're doing that. And as you said, even if he were, would he change? No, not necessarily, but you may be able to shift that conversation. So I would recommend that you might try saying to him, Bob, could I have a few minutes to at least join this conversation and share what I think? Would you be open, Bob, to me sharing my opinion on here? You mentioned he interrupts a lot, right? And often I see this in meetings when people tend to interrupt me less, perhaps because of the work I do, but I see them interrupting others and I always stop them and say, Bob, sorry, could you let Luca finish, please? Could you just give him a moment? Because actually he was sharing.
So you need a referee,
right?
In that situation.
Yeah, a bit of a referee, but also intentionality, right? Which is another one of those trending words we spoke about earlier, but it's a really powerful word to have intention because people often do need reminding. You know, we tell people to listen, but we very rarely teach them to listen. And Bob might need help with that listening. So I would really encourage you to ask, to request for that. You know, when there are difficult things in the room, when you name them, they shrink. It's hard.
Yeah.
It takes a bit of confidence, especially if there's seniority in the mix. So that would be the first thing that I would really encourage you to do is ask for that permission to speak and then give him feedback. You know, so if Bob is then cutting off again, tell him, sorry, Bob, I'm sorry to stop you mid-flow.
Yeah.
But could I finish, please?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you noticed, but you cut me off. I really want to just get to the end of my thought here, right? And then once people realize that, they often change their behavior.
So let's take a time out away from now, from the Bob situation. So what you were doing there was you were giving great role playing.
Thank you.
Giving feedback based on a working culture of how to empathize in a way with someone else for that voice to then be heard.
Yes.
You're bringing judgments there. You're bringing some bias because you're giving an opinion, right? Or no?
I would have to listen back to every word I said to see if I passed any judgment. I would try not to, right? Yeah. So, say maybe Bob is experiencing some of these things. There may be a reason he talks a lot, that he's not very good at being interrupted. At the end of the day, empathy's backbone is curiosity, right? Because if you want to understand somebody else, you have to use your curiosity. You have to ask questions.
Yeah.
And often, and this is really interesting, Luca, that in organizational conflict or organizational complexities, if we go back to the scenario for a minute, what you think the challenge is and what Bob thinks the challenge is often two different things, but you don't get to that understanding unless you ask. Yeah. So sometimes in conflict, you will say to somebody, often in husband and wife, right? Yeah. What do you think the problem is here? When they actually tell the problem, both of them have a different idea of what that problem is.
Nice.
So you have to use those open-ended questions.
On that note, you're basically going to take charge of the show. You've got your own podcast. You've had your own podcast before. You've done another one. So you know how to host. You're in charge now of hosting.
Okay.
In this bag, you've got a bunch of golf balls with questions written on them.
Okay.
Take one at a time, read it out loud, and let's have a chat.
Right.
Hey guys, it's me again. Do you get worried about giving a speech or, you know, being on a podcast or being someone that's been told to present in front of their client or to their boss? A lot of people have anxiety when it comes to public speaking. In fact, 74% of every one of us is terrified about the idea of standing in front of other people and trying to convince them of something. The good news is there's a lot of people that can help. In fact, I've launched my own training program, which I'm calling Master Pitch, which combines my 20 years of corporate background running big businesses, dealing with clients, as well as my own personal passion point of presenting in front of large audiences or being on camera, or in fact, even being on the Inside Track. So if you want to improve things like your tone, your pace, your storytelling narrative, and how to structure it properly, as well as to understand your audience better and to drive real impact, I'm sure I can help you out. Whether individual level or at a corporate level, my Master Pitch training program can definitely make you a better public speaker. So drop me an email at info@lukaallam.com or check out my website, lukaallam.com, if you want to find out more information, more details. Right, let's get back to the show.
Did you write these questions, Luca?
I did. No AI used.
No, not even a tiny bit of ChatGPT.
No, a little bit. This is all me. And every single guest has a different question. Never ask the same question twice.
Did you cut out this tiny little piece of paper and stick it on?
Yep.
You are the best host ever.
I did that myself.
Right. I did that last time.
And that golf ball, I probably played golf at some point.
Amazing. So I'm literally holding onto a moment of your life. Okay. What's worse, belonging to a nothing or nothing to belong to? Gosh.
So you talked about loneliness before.
I did.
This is why it's triggered.
Wow.
What's worse?
Belonging to a nothing or nothing to belong to. I think nothing to belong to. Because that would be very sad, right? If you are living in an environment where you have nothing that you can belong to, that you have lost whatever you originally had, because we're all born with some form of belonging. So if you have no group, no family, no workplace, no society or association or religious institution to belong to, you're not going to do very well.
And that's a lot of people that we kind of talked about before. There's
330 million people, yes.
Who feel that level of loneliness because they don't have a friend.
Yes, nothing to belong to. And the sad thing is we all have something to belong to, but we don't always know where to look for it.
Or they don't feel it. They may do, but they don't recognize it. They're not aware of it. They're not self-aware.
Mm.
So they need someone to kind of say, actually, you do belong to this. You do belong to that. You're all part of a wider community, a group. But.
And you have to step out into that. You know, people often ask me about how do I make more friends or how do I overcome my loneliness? And I always say to them, the only person that can do it is you.
Do we get lonelier the older we get?
Not necessarily, but some people do, so especially in Western cultures where we just abandon our elderly, right? So yes, you know. But no, I don't think necessarily. I think for many people, they completely discover themselves and they may have been very lonely in younger life, in teenage years, in their 20s.
Is this a generation that me and you are in right now where we're kind of on autopilot for quite a long time? We've been institutionalized through an educational system, et cetera, et cetera. We conform to something. We don't really have our own identity. But then the older we get, the more comfortable we get within our own skin and what we are and what we're not. And we actually become, like you're saying, more in charge of our own life, more self-aware and actually richer because of it.
Maybe more self-aware, but also more self-confident. I think that's a huge part of growing older, is finding that confidence and often just being comfortable with discomfort, right? Because unfortunately for us, nothing exceptional ever comes from a comfort zone. So if you don't step out of that zone to meet new people, to belong in new places, to find new places for you to build your identity, you'll never find them, right? That's why I said it starts with you.
Yeah.
Overcoming loneliness is not about everyone else. You can't be a victim in that reality. There are people out there that want to know you. I promise you that.
Yeah.
But if you stay at home and watch Netflix for another 3 hours, you are not going to find them.
Yeah. For those who are watching Netflix, we don't mind the inside track being on Netflix. It's a great platform. We love it. But yeah, your point is absolutely
taken. I love Netflix. Yeah, I really do. I mean, I do my learning on Netflix. Yeah, I do my escapism on Netflix.
It's okay. You don't need to plug it. It's okay.
No,
it's okay.
But the problem is,
we're not on Netflix yet. It's coming.
We will be, though. Yeah, we will be. And when we are, we're going to take this clip 100%. And like put it on like right Times Square billboard.
Love it.
But it's really important because there is no problem with escapism. We need escapism. The world is extremely tough out there. But if you wallow in that escapism, you can't then fulfill your potential, right? Because you never leave the house.
What have you escaped from in your life?
What have I escaped from? You know, the first thing that came to mind, Britain.
The weather.
But I've been gone for a very long time. So when people ask me, where are you from? I find it quite a hard question. And nowadays I say, well, my passport is British.
Yeah. You live in Kuala Lumpur right now, right?
I do. I live in Kuala Lumpur. But as I said earlier, I've been in this region for 20 years and I find it extremely hard to live in the West. Like more or less impossible. I can visit, but I can't live there. My soul is just not from there for sure. So I did escape that and I will never go back.
But what about your corporate life? Did you not feel like you weren't being yourself or you weren't allowed to be yourself truly? Or were you excelling in that, but you just wanted something else? I mean, not just from a physical escapism, but more from a sort of a mental or emotional escapism.
Do you know what, Luca? I loved my work. I never ran away from it. I mean, is it tough? Yes. Particularly, I think, in this region, it's a tough industry and I had some very tough times. And I often tell the story about why I wrote my first book and it came out of, I was extremely overwhelmed. I had a very, very tough time. Having said that, I loved my work. As I said earlier, I followed my dad's footsteps into that industry. I wanted to stay forever. So I loved it. I wasn't escaping the corporate world. People ask me this all the time, actually. I don't feel like I have a trauma story that I ran away from. But certainly on the other side of that decision, I have found great joy. Nice. And that's a gift, don't you think? It's a gift, right? Because not all of us get to do that.
No.
But it's not easy, right? You know, today, someone a few hours ago, while I was just on my way here, she said to me, oh, Mimi, you are so lucky, on her message. And I said, you know what, I thank you and I feel it. However.
Yeah, there's a negative association coming.
Well, however, I do believe that we create our own luck. You know, back to the example of staying at home and not putting yourself out your comfort zone. I love what I do. I mean, I really love it.
It shows. It absolutely shows.
But it's really hard, right? Yeah. It's really hard to leave my daughter all the time. It's really hard to turn up in all of these countries entirely alone in the middle of the night, you know, and to try and unlock my banking app when I'm in like some crazy town in India, right? So it's really hard. And I think that social media makes it look easy.
Yeah.
Right, that you just turn up and end up on sets like this.
It glorifies everything.
It's fine to like do your hair and have a nice pink dress and a great mug from somebody in Sri Lanka, right? You create that. It doesn't just appear in your world. And I think tenacity, people talk about resilience, but that's also trending, right? But tenacity for me is a better word. That tenacity to keep going in that joy is something.
On that note, let's keep going with the balls.
Oh my gosh, okay. I hope the next one's easier, Luca. Hi, Kifek. Ça va? How much do we not want to know the real answer? Yes, brilliant question.
So just to give context, hi, Kifek, ça va is what a lot of Lebanese people specifically say to people because it's English, it's Arabic, and it's French.
Yes.
Say, hey, how you doing? Are you good? All well? Yeah. And they don't allow you to actually even answer the question before.
Yes, they walk off.
before they go on to the next thing. Yeah. Hi, how's it going? I get all good? Yeah, let's move on. So how true is that? And how dangerous is that people never actually want to know the real answer?
Yeah, it's a problem. It's funny you ask me because I ask my audience it all the time. How many times a day do you say, hey, how are you? I'm fine, thanks. How are you? And then you walk off. Yeah. No, but you didn't ask anybody anything, right? You didn't actually ask anybody. So I'm not sure it's dangerous, right? I'm not sure it's a dangerous reality, but it is a hole. It is a gap. And when you do it differently, right? So when I just did it with my Uber driver on the way here, you know, you get in the car, I say, hi, good morning, how are you? And they say, I'm fine, thanks. And then they go silent, right? They expect it to end. And I say to them, well, how's your morning? And they go, it's fine, thanks.
Look at you spreading the empathy everywhere.
Honestly, Luca, everywhere.
It's almost like you have a training program called Empathy Everywhere. Oh, wait.
Oh, look at that.
You have one.
Look at that, amazing, right? Amazing. So I wouldn't say it's dangerous, but I do think that when you are aware of how much you are not connecting with people. And then you make tiny, I call them micro shifts, right? Tiny micro shifts to make eye contact, to smile. Oh my gosh, the power of a smile, right? We are neurologically programmed to respond to a smile. It makes people feel better. So smile more. Why do people think that smiling is like not okay in the corporate world? So how you deliver that, hey, how are you? And people know I mean it when I say it to them. I ask like 100 people a day, particularly service staff, right?
Yeah.
Barristers, waiters, security staff, anyone I meet, air hostesses and hosts.
Yeah.
And they always answer. And they don't just walk off because they know you mean it.
Yeah.
But it's in the eyes and it's in the smile.
Yeah. So I do something when someone asks me, how am I doing? I actually tell them sometimes. Every now and I have fun with it because but I'm telling them the truth. And at the end of it, they're like, I don't know what to do with that information. I'm like,
well, you asked.
Yeah.
Right?
So
you asked me.
Can you look into the camera and say to the people that say, hi, qui fix, ça va, what not to do? Or to say something that's gonna no longer allow them to ask that question because it does potential some damage.
No, listen, what I would say is ask that question. Definitely ask it. It's a nice thing to ask people how they are, but you have to mean it. So do it with your eyes open, your shoulders squared, and smile, and then pause at the end of that sentence. Because if you say, hi, qui fax, ça va, and carry on, you haven't ever given them a chance to answer. So carry on asking people how they are. But the trick here is you have to actually want to know.
So on that note,
yes.
How are you, Mimi?
How am I? Well, I am very busy running around the world. I'm missing my daughter because she's not here, but I am really enjoying my work. You know, I really feel, look at the something changed in my world in the last 4 months. It's intangible. I don't know what it is, but it has changed. And people are very kind to me. And that feels... I feel very grateful for that. You know, I think there's always going to be people that hate what you do. I'm sure there's many, right? Who say, why is she talking about empathy again? But on the whole, you know, the amazing thing in this region particularly is the more I do, the more people invite me to meet their parents.
Okay.
How amazing is that?
Okay.
I don't often get to do it, but people so often say, can I take you home to meet my
mom? Maybe they've got issues and they want you to fix the issues the mom and dad.
Potentially, but I'm not a coach, so I never would. But I'm very well. I'm very well in this journey. It's nerve-wracking. As I said earlier, it's stressful, you know?
Yeah. Give me a percentage of people that actually answer the truth when they get asked, how are you?
I don't know, but I would guess 1%. What about you, Luca? How are you?
I'm a bit tired physically. Mm-hmm. I had a late night last night.
Were you covering golf balls?
I was, but I did that earlier. But I was preparing for today's. Today I have a long day of recording today. But so physically tired, but inside my mind, I'm hopeful that I can do you justice and all of my guests justice today to bring the very best out of them. So in the back of my mind, I always have this kind of hope that I can deliver a great piece of content. So that's how I'm feeling. Right, let's move on to next ball because we've got a lot to get through, Mimi.
Oh my gosh!
We've got six more crackers.
Oh my gosh! Okay. Misconception or truth? Women are better listeners than men. Boom.
Misconception or truth?
No, it's misconception. From a data point of view.
I don't believe it.
No, I will tell you. So from a DNA and a sort of a data. What do I want? The word I want. Physiological data point of view, we are exactly the same. And they have studied it.
Yeah.
And there is no proof that in our DNA, in our brains, we are any better at listening than men. However, there is generational proof that we are better practiced at listening than men. So the last three words actually of my first book are practice creates permanence. Mm-hmm. So never, ever aim for perfection because you'll never get there. And the distance between expectation and reality is disappointment.
But I will challenge you, shouldn't you aim for perfection and get to like 90% and be very, very happy with it?
Because you won't be very happy because anybody that aims for perfection wants perfection.
Okay.
And that gap between expectation, 100%, and reality, 90%, is disappointment.
So there's a lot of companies talk about OKRs, objectives and key results, where the whole principle of OKRs, you stretch for the goal of, I want 100% growth next year, but if they end up with 50%, they're delighted. But if they don't set the target of 100% growth, and they only aim for 50, they get 20. So their belief is to overstretch yourself or over aim and end up with a higher norm than you would have got had if you hadn't
overstretched. But that's probably because those leaders are A-type personalities who strive on that. The reality is most people don't.
Okay,
but back to your question, do women listen better than men? No, but we do have better practice, and that is generational. So when you look back from an evolutionary point of view, when we were hunter-gatherers and then for all the generations that came after that, the men left the home to hunt and gather or to work to earn money to feed the family. The women were left in the communities with the grandmas, the aunties, the children. We had to listen. We had to listen to create cohesion in society, to feed them and clean and home and educate, to do all the things we did for our society. So there is data that shows that generationally, we have generational wisdom, which makes us better listeners. But what I will say is many of the thinkers in this space around listening, around empathy, people like Satya Nadella, actually, he's the CEO of Microsoft, are men. So most of the work coming out of the space is coming from men. So you have no excuse. That's it. You are not off the hook. That's it. I'm sorry.
Next question.
Moving on.
Yeah, on that note.
easy to find loneliness, even easier to hide it. Oh, that's sad. How true is that? I think it's so true. If we're talking about men and women, even more so in men. I think men in my audiences, they find it so hard to say that I'm really lonely. The older they get, the easier that is. And I think it's because they leave the corporate world and they feel more empowered and less pressure to be able to share that reality.
Is there a cultural angle as well? Proud Arab men?
Sure.
The Arab man usually is not...
Proud Indian men, proud Sri Lankan. I mean, everywhere. Proud men. There we go. But it is true. I think many people hide it. But I also think that many people don't know the suffering with it. Mm. I think often when I ask my audiences about loneliness, I can see them go tick, 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 tick. Yeah. And they're like, oh, I feel like that. Maybe I'm lonely, Mimi. I say, well, maybe you are.
So how do you know if you're lonely? Is it feeling? Can you be objective about it?
I think you probably can be objective about it, but that's probably quite a high performing skill set. So I think it's probably a feeling for most people. It's the feeling that I don't belong or that I don't have anyone that is like me or gets me. You know, when people say, nobody gets me, and you hear this in teenagers a lot, nobody understands, that's loneliness. Mm. That feeling that you are alone in how you see or feel or want to live in the world. And there are so many, Luca.
So how do we get people to feel that they don't have to hide it any longer?
I think we have to keep having this conversation. It's the same with any form of mental health, particularly in this region and South Asia, where these are still very taboo for many people to admit this, right? I must be strong. I must be a leader. I must stand up. The admission of that holds great power, but we have to have many more conversations until that becomes remotely normal. Do companies' reliance on HR help or hinder wider empathy adoption? What do you mean by...
Yeah, so companies normally, when they have an HR director, HR team, they're like... HR team will take care of it. They'll manage it. They'll make sure that there is empathy in the workplace or people are treating each other well. People are listening to each other well. People are giving feedback in the proper ways.
Yes.
Outsourcing to HR, is that literally helping the company or is that hindering the company?
I don't think you can outsource to an in-source team, right? So you can't outsource anything to HR.
But you know what I mean? It's a function rather than as a culture.
Yes. No, it's probably, the answer is probably a total cop-out, but it's probably both. Is it helping? Yes, because at least somebody's leaving it. Like someone has to lead this conversation. I say to my clients, what you measure will manifest.
Yeah.
If you do not put empathy, active listening, these types of skill sets into your KPIs, into your culture, into your expectations of those teams, they won't happen because we're humans and we're busy, right? Yeah. So you have to manifest it. So we need to rely on HR to lead this, to create shifts, to create culture, all of these types of things. But if you only rely on HR, then you're going to fail. Because if you are the CEO and you don't role model this, then it is a complete waste of their time.
So I would argue it hinders. I would say it hinders more than it helps. The simple reason it's, you kind of say it's someone else's job. Someone else will lead that. Someone else will do that.
Yes.
Someone else will enforce it. When actually empathy has to be indoctrinated with everybody in the company.
It's everybody's job. Yeah. It is, but I do believe it's both. You won't succeed without, I mean, it can be HR, it can be anything.
They
can drive it and systemize it, and it does need a system because somebody has to book the training programs and somebody has to create the learnings on the LMS and somebody has to help. You know, some of the businesses I work with are 570,000 people. Mm. Right? The CEO can't impact them, not all of them, not equally, right? Mm. So you have to have HR and they do a phenomenal job, but they are exhausted, Luca. I think HR is probably the function out there that is the most burnt out, the most tired. And actually, I know another statistic because I used it this weekend. 45% of HR leaders, this is really depressing, do not trust their CEO. All right, so that's nearly half of all HR leaders don't even trust what they're saying, right? So yeah, it's everybody's role and you can't outsource it to your insourced team.
Love it.
Next golf ball, right?
Hey, it's your show.
I'm ready. It's my show.
It's your show.
Can we call it the Mimi and Luca show?
I'm just listening.
Here we go. you've got it. Right, the next golf ball from Emirates Golf Club, I might add, is misconception or truth. Men need their caveman time. In my head, I read that as man cave, but caveman. Is it a misconception or truth?
It is man cave, but as a caveman.
You just did that to make it difficult for me to read.
It should be man cave. It should be man cave.
Okay, but either way, it's got a smiley. Can you see that?
I put a little smiley face on it. Because I usually put one question that's a little bit lighthearted.
Okay, so what do you think?
Man cave time is fundamental.
Of course. Why? Tell me.
Honestly, it's in the top five things for a man to do every day.
Well, then answer your own question, Luca. Tell me.
No, but you're a woman. You're an empathy expert.
No. Yes, so I will answer it after you. I want to know why. Why? Why is it so integral? I was allowed to ask you questions, right? The listener has to listen over here.
Okay, so why do men need their caveman, man cave time? Because they can only absorb a certain amount of information.
Right.
Sensory overload when they come from work is probably at its highest.
Yeah.
And they got to a point where they just need to decompress.
Okay.
And have some alone time to reflect on what's just happened before they can process, before they can move on to the next task, which is pretty much looking after the family.
Yep.
Or being part of the family dynamic, whatever you want to say. So yes, I think man cave time or caveman time, whatever you want to call it, is fundamental. Because without it, I don't think men will get a chance to ever have any time for themselves because the expectations on men are massive.
Walking on a fine line, my friend.
Oh, God. I retract everything.
Retract all of it. No, but here, but why then, as humans, why does a woman not need a woman cave?
I didn't say that.
You said that men need them as fundamental because they need time out when they get back to reflect on their day.
Yeah.
But what if both of us work? Let's pretend we're married for a
moment. I'm not talking about women,
right?
I'm talking about men.
I know.
You
but
brought
what
the
if
female.
I need, what if I need
Don't
a
bring
female?
The female bias over here. That's your own what? Bias that
no,
you're judging.
No, there's no bias.
I've
just
out-empathized
saying.
You. You brought your own
what
bias.
What if I need a woman cave, right? Can women have this? Is it integral to men? My question is it integral to men more than women?
I don't know because I'm not a woman.
This
and
is true.
I can't judge that. So the question was about, because we talk about in society about caveman, man cave time, right?
Yeah.
Man needs his cave.
Man needs a cave, however
so,
you look at it.
So we talk less about a female needing a cave. Whatever, if that's right or wrong, in terms of, you know, pop culture, society, it's talked about much less.
Yeah.
So that's where the question comes from. Do women need a cave as much as the men do? I don't know.
Can I have a palace instead of a cave?
But all I can tell you is this. For every man who comes home from work, the last thing they want is more sensory input. They just need a timeout. 5 minute, 10 minute, half hour. I read a stat the other day about how much time men spend in the toilet when they come home. Have you heard about this?
It sounds disgusting.
Not in that way, but it's the only sort of refuge that they have. So the cave has become the modern day toilet, right? So I think it's fundamental for all men. Women, there's something else.
No, I think it's probably fundamental to all humans would be actually the answer to your question from my point of view. I think all humans need time out. Like, again, I am a working mum, so I fully resonate, although I am not a man, I fully resonate with the feeling you are explaining, right? So when you say men, me, I, we come home and we need a moment without any more sensorial overload. Unfortunately, I very rarely get it because I have a child and dogs and cats and a million other things I need doing. So I don't often get it. But does the human need an opportunity to retreat, to recharge, to reflect? Yes. So I think maybe the days of man caves are slightly numbered, but the need to have space to reflect, wherever that is, I'm not going to mention your other story there. But for me, it's on the aeroplane. So for me, when I get on a plane, especially, I mean, I fly here most weeks, it's 7.5 hours.
It's an expensive man cave.
It is, but thanks to Emirates, it's a very comfortable one.
Okay. Sponsored by Emirates.
Yes.
So there is. So going back to the question, it's true. It's truth, not misconception. There is a truth in that. For all the women listening, men need their caveman time.
No, I'm totally cannot put my name to that statement. I think that all humans need an opportunity to escape, and I'm moving your conversation on. Right. This one says, what limits empathy more, smartphones, AI, or stress and less time? Definitely stress or less time. Definitely. And I could talk for hours about AI because actually it will drive our empathy, not decrease it. But the reality is that empathy has two great enemies, and it's due to neuroscience. Our brains fundamentally cannot access our empathy, the prefrontal cortex, when we are living under high stress environments, because that's the way the brain works, right? So when you sit under high stress, you may have heard of the fight or flight response. Back to cavemen, not caves, but cavemen. When we were cave people, when we were living in jungles or forests or wherever we were living, plains, when we would come out and we would be approached by a saber-toothed tiger, we had two choices. We could fight the tiger or flight the tiger, i.e. run away. And from an evolutionary point of view, our bodies therefore evolved to reflect that in our bodies. So when you recognize the fear, what happens in your brain is you release a whole lot of hormones, adrenaline, cortisol. You are literally moving the blood and the energy away from the thinking parts of your brain. You don't need to strategize right now. You need to survive, right? So that you can run. So it's pumping blood to your lungs, your heart, your legs, your limbs, so you can run and fight. Now, we have evolved in a myriad of ways, but our brains today still cannot define between types of stress.
Different anxiety.
So whether it's a saber-toothed tiger or a toxic boss, your brain will respond the same way. So when you feel that stress and strain, and we're not meant to live under this, Luca, you know, these hormones in our body, and I'm obviously not a doctor, but they're not meant to stay in your body. They do great. They help us deeply. They're there to protect you. They're literally there to keep you alive. But when they are sustained in your body, they also do great harm. We're not meant to live with them for extended periods of time. And of course, the state of the world means that we are more often than not. So we cannot empathize when we're living under that. So if you do have if you're nervous, if you're unhappy, if you're anxious, if you have a toxic boss, you cannot access that empathy. So when you argue with someone and they say to you, can you just focus on the facts? No, they can't, because that part of the brain is quite literally not working right
now.
Switched off. So yeah, so the greatest negative impact on our empathy is that high stress and low time.
So if I'm looking at my phone and I'm talking to you, how empathetic can I be if I'm disengaged?
Yeah, no, it's very hard. And actually there is data out there that shows that even the presence of a phone reduces the quality of our connectivity. So if you did have a phone in your pocket and you had put it on the table right now, for me, but also for all the viewers who are watching in video, mm-hmm. something would shift in their subconscious.
Exactly. That's why the question is, but you said actually it's a lesser evil than the no time and having that sort of stress sort of environment.
It's a lesser evil because if I had my phone here, because I'm very good at listening and empathizing, I would make up for it.
So why would AI, you mentioned AI, why would AI make us more empathetic?
No, I don't think it would make us more empathetic, but it will create more empathy itself. So people are very scared of AI, and people often say that the difference between us and AI, as if we need to prove that we're different, right? Because clearly we're quite different. But just in case you were wondering, people believe that the difference between AI and us is our ability to empathize or use other emotions that people talk about on LinkedIn. The reality is, as we've touched on, the human race is failing at empathy. Hence, we have an empathy deficit, right? We're really bad at it. Why would we not want the machines to fill the gaps when we know how beneficial it is to the human race? So we've already established that it makes us live longer. It literally protects the survival of the human race. If ChatGPT or any other platform, no brand affiliation over here, can improve empathy between people that don't otherwise have it, I mean, roll on AI. It's good for humanity. It's good for our planet. I mean, if you think about a young woman in Kenya, right, who lives in a rural town, and goes to school every day and is incredibly talented. She's never going to hear the word coach, let alone get one. Her family members aren't necessarily super able to help her with career decisions and her future because they grew up in the village. They don't have that knowledge. Currently, she goes home every night and sits in her home alone and wonders how she could do this differently. But imagine in the future, if she can log on and ask her AI coach, friend, bot, how am I doing? How might I do this differently? Would this work? Is there another town in my country like me? Is there a way to get from point A to point B quicker than I believe? Right? She has access to the whole world. And it's proven that within 2 minutes when we communicate with a bot, this is hilarious, we forget that they're a bot, which is why when you are on like an airline website talking to the bot and you're like, you are not understanding me. Can you help me, you know, pass me to a manager? And the bot is like, I'm sorry, I do not understand that command, right?
Yeah.
But you have forgotten that they're a bot.
Yeah.
You're angry with a machine. We need AI to empathize, and it will.
AI is, so the whole world, there's a word called sentience where AI starts to feel like humans, think like humans, act like humans. Are you scared about that?
No, I think it's brilliant. Because we're failing as people.
So we need the help.
We need to fill the gaps. Yeah, we need the
help. Based on my maths, there should be one bull left.
There is one bull left.
All
is
right.
Is it the best one?
I have no idea. I think it's about a cat.
It is. It is about a cat, which just walked past your window just now. I just got distracted by a very beautiful cat. Curiosity kills cats, apparently, but it cures the human condition debate.
Do you know the phrase curiosity killed the cat?
I do, yes.
It's an old phrase.
It's very old.
Yeah. But it helps cure the human condition. If you're curious, if you ask, if you probe, that will lead to better understanding and that will hopefully remove loneliness. Anxiety,
yes,
stress.
I said it earlier, right? That the backbone to all empathy is curiosity. So I have no research to back up what I'm about to say. I have no idea.
I love that. I basically spent my entire career doing that,
just winging it, right?
Yeah.
So I have no idea where the phrase curiosity killed the cat really came from, but I'm going to make an assumption that it came from probably from Britain and from a time in Western, at least, society.
About 200 years ago.
Well, there we go. Where the people of power in the room, which were probably men at the time, wanted to control the conversation. And I would imagine that the phrase curiosity kills the cat comes from people trying to dissuade people that they didn't value from asking questions that they didn't want to answer. So I think curiosity kills the cat is probably a phrase that comes from a time when people didn't want to be challenged. They didn't want perhaps women, perhaps female voices in the room or other levels, statuses within society to challenge or have an opinion. It's a very unpsychologically safe phrase, right? So I think it holds no standing today. There is no environment, Luca, where curiosity wouldn't improve things, I don't think. So I think the debate is old versus new.
Yeah.
Archaic versus modern, perhaps.
But it does cure the human condition if you have curiosity.
For sure.
Imagine everyone was curious how the world works.
Yes, it would change everything. It does change everything. Yeah. You know, in my workshops, we run little sessions where people do this, where they ask questions and I only give them 90 seconds. And the reason I give them 90 seconds is to prove to them that you can listen in under 2 minutes and understand something new about people, to be curious.
Yeah.
Because every leader tells me, I'd have time, Mimi. Mm. You do have time.
Yeah.
Everybody has 90 seconds.
Yeah. It's a perfect segue to giving you another ball, which is blank.
Okay.
And usually the part of the show where I'd ask my guests to ask any question, to be curious.
Right.
That they would like to ask me.
Right.
Or to say something that they haven't quite said,
but
they think it's important for the audience to know. So you have the power, Mimi.
Do you know there's 6 forms of power in the world? Did you know that? That's not my question.
Enlighten me.
No, just that there are 6 forms of power, and within those forms of power, you will always be able to make people do things, but it is never sustained. So when you say to someone you have the power in the room, it will always be short-lived. Anyway, that was not my question. My question, gosh, I have so many I could ask you, but why did you start this show? I was thinking this all the way here. Why? Why do you want to be on camera every day and film 3? Why do you love it? What is it that drives you? Do we need another podcast? That's my question.
Yeah, do you know when I launched the podcast, I don't call it a podcast, but
what do you call it?
It's a show. It's a show. It's a chat show. It's a talk show. It's an online show, whatever you want to call it.
What's the difference between that and a podcast?
I would say podcast is mainly built for audio.
Right.
Less about video. Yeah. Okay. There's a stat that came out of the US relatively recently. You have Gallup. I have my own stats.
Yeah.
84% of all Gen Z, when they're listening to podcasts, there has to be a video component next to it. So video is absolutely essential now when it comes to content creation, especially in the audio space as well.
Mm.
And the minute that we, now, I don't know if you're aware, but season 1, season 2, our content is on OSN. It's also on Shahid. So the sort of the small format is now on the big format. That
Amazing.
Makes sense. So you've got this kind of weird sort of intersection between media, how old and new kind of mix, and how big and small in terms of formats also mix. So it's not a podcast in its typical sense because it's on mainstream linear TV, as well as being able to be found and discoverable on audio streaming platforms. So look, you're not the first person to ask me this question.
That's disappointing.
But that's okay. It's okay because it serves to revalidate what I do. Now, I noticed something about you. You say my name, Luca, every sort of 10 minutes or so. When you talk to me, you'll drop in Luca.
Do I? Did I?
You do it because you make it more personal. You do it because you make you come across as more genuine and more authentic.
Mm.
Okay. And also to connect with me, to let me know that I can be open and authentic also with you.
Mm.
So why I do this is because I want to get people on to create content that is fundamentally authentic to who they are, but can give a sense of good into the world.
Oh, I love that.
Because there isn't enough good in the world.
There isn't.
And the content that I've been seeing and I've been exposed to, the questions people ask, the sensationalism around creating content on social platforms or even on TV, it's all nonsense, man. It's all nonsense. And honestly, like, I thought, let me take charge from my own, within my own domain. If 100 people watch or no one watches, it's still okay. But at least I know that I'm producing something that I would want to listen to or watch.
Yeah.
And I can't be the only one. So producing quality content is fundamental why I did this.
Mm.
There's a selfish reason. It's because I love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love getting to know people. In this line of work, I call it work,
I've
met unbelievable personalities, which I would never have met beforehand. So I would like to consider that I can now call you a friend in the future, right? So I now understand more about empathy than I did. When I get to research my guests, I go through pages of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I'm learning all the time. So there's a development, a self-development that I take, that I also take into consideration when I create the show. I'm getting better as a person because I'm getting more rounded. I'm getting more informed. I'm getting more access to insights.
Mm.
And that's what the whole thing is about. So giving the world quality content, doing something I generally love and learning stuff in the process, it's kind of wrapped around the big why. But there's one other why which I do what I do. And that's because there's a legacy factor.
Okay.
I want to stand for something. I've seen in corporate when you rise in the corporate ladder, you play things relatively safe, generally speaking, right? You have to say the right things. You've got to align yourself with the right stakeholders. You've got to watch what you say and what you do. Mm. And you're kind of living within a shell, man.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This is me coming out of my shell, but I'm doing it. I'm uncomfortable, to your point earlier about being uncomfortable. I'm feeling alive because I'm coming out of my shell and saying stuff and doing stuff I would never have normally done.
Mm.
So it's a great feeling.
It is a great feeling. When people ask you, you told me I had power. I'm taking it all. people, now you don't have a secret safe word, right? But when people ask you at a party, what do you do? What do you say?
Yeah, I struggle with that.
It's a hard one.
Because
right?
I used to say, I'm a CEO of a multinational media agency. I work in advertising. I work in media.
Yes.
If I then say, and honestly, I've struggled with this because it's everyone is, so, especially in Dubai, it's a title-led industry.
That's why I'm asking.
And I've learned this. A lot of people, if people leave their corporate, they don't have a title. Who are they?
Mm.
What do they stand for? What are they about? And a lot of people lose your credibility when you lose your title.
Mm. And like, your identity.
Your identity.
Right?
That should never happen. You shouldn't have to feel that you have to stay in a job and have a title to know who you are as a person. It's fundamentally wrong. So when people ask me, I used to struggle a lot. I used to say, you know, I'm doing my own thing. I was a bit kind of vague, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. I've got my own show, but I also do a couple of other things. And now I'm kind of getting my head around the sense of be proud of what you're doing. So if someone asks me what I'm doing now, I'll tell them I'm a host, I'm a podcaster, and I'm loving my life.
Do your kids know that? Do they know what daddy does?
They haven't got a clue what I do.
Oh, I love that.
But every now and again, they see the setup in the living room.
Yeah.
And they come and they want to film. And even my eldest son, Matthew, he copies my intro of season one and season two.
Sweet.
He's super cute. So they don't know. But what the nice thing also, all the content I'm creating in years to come, whether people are slagging me off or not, or they love the content, at least my kids will know what their dad was like. What was he like on camera? What was he like meeting people? What did he believe in? What did he think? So there's also a posterity angle to it.
It's amazing when you see yourself through your kids' eyes, right?
Yeah.
Because they see us as heroes, actually, and they see it so differently. The other day, my daughter's school plans every event around my flight schedule, i.e. when I'm on a plane, that's when they put the event on. So the other day, someone else told me that at this event, the teacher said to my daughter, who is 7, you know, where's mummy? She said, she's a celebrity, so she's teaching people to be kind. Yeah. And this teacher was like,
beautiful.
Okay, I mean, I'm definitely not a celebrity, but in her eyes. And so then her stepdad said to her, mummy's not a celebrity. And Umi says, she is because she's on YouTube. And you start to realize what they understand, how this generation will define who we are in the future. You know, that feeling you spoke about there, Luca, saying, and I used to fumble around a bit and I didn't really know who I was without my title. I think the next generation will move beyond it. I think see value in a really different way. So
I hope so. Because that was a lonely time. Because when you don't know who you are, what you're doing, you're transitioning. I'm like, who the hell am I?
Because you get up every day and do this on your own. I mean, I know that feeling so well.
Yeah. And you question yourself constantly.
Oh my gosh, all the time.
And you're like,
should I do this or that? There's nobody to help, right? Is this the right thing to do?
No.
Should I spend this $10 on this thing or that thing?
They have no idea what it takes to do this.
No.
The work that goes into it is unbelievable. But the feeling I get once I stop recording now on these cameras, I love it. And that's what energizes me. And also the feedback from the guests. I love most of the guests I have on the show are referrals from other guests.
Yeah.
They're like, Luke, I love coming on. I want to get that makes me feel amazing. It's like, it's great.
You know? It's value, right? Yeah. It's valuable in the world.
Yeah. Mimi, it's been fantastic having you on. You've added
amazing.
A lot of value.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
You're the queen of empathy.
Oh, thank
you. Are a foremost world expert, whatever you want to call it, on empathy, how we started the show.
It's
been great having you, really. And I don't need to wish you the best because you are already doing what you're doing and you deserve everything good and you deserve to share the goodness and you are doing that. So keep doing it.
Well, thank you for inviting me because the only way I can do this work is by exemplifying it. And I believe that the more the world talks about empathy, the more empathy the world will have. There's never been a time when we needed it more. So thank you.
Yeah. Mimi, it's been great having you on. Guys, I hope you've been listening. Stay tuned for the next episode of Luca's Inside Track.
Neu in der Deutschlandcard-App. Sammle Punkte mit deinen Kassenbons von DM, Rossmann und vielen weiteren Supermärkten und Drogerien. Einfach Kassenbons scannen, punkten und sparen. Jetzt gratis mit der Deutschlandcard-App.